This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.
It's Wednesday, the 11th of December, and this is your BizNews briefing. In tonight's show, we bring you the very latest on Bitcoin, Israel's airstrikes wipe out Syria's military capacity, Shell and BP retrace on renewables, and President-elect Trump starts running the US economy on his X platform. Now, Microsoft has voted against using Bitcoin as a strategic asset on its balance sheet. Earlier today, I caught up with Fazam Ehsani, the CEO of Valor, to get the lowdown.
Yeah, news that there was a vote that came from Microsoft that said that they wouldn't be using Bitcoin as an asset strategic reserve on their balance sheet. Obviously, some people disappointed, but the majority is thinking that that's not the right way to go for the company. I think this is to be expected in some ways because people have seen the meteoric rise of Bitcoin over the last month and 10, 11 days. A reminder that at the beginning of November, Bitcoin was trading at $69,000. Right now, we're trading just around the $98,000 mark, so above 50% up in just over a month. So there's bound to be some people that are looking at this as a bit too high, a bit too soon type of a price movement and saying that maybe we should wait. I think many people, like myself, believe that the price is going to be going up much higher, although there will be a lot of volatility. I wouldn't be surprised to see some significant drawbacks. So I expect that there will be companies like Microsoft that will say no right now. But I think overall, we are seeing a trend towards actually looking at it as a safe haven asset. I will say two things about that. Number one, Ray Dalio, as many people know, one of the great investors of our time, has come out to say that he would be looking at gold and Bitcoin as assets to be investing in. And then the other person that people should pay attention to is Larry Fink, who is the BlackRock CEO, the CEO of the largest asset manager in the world. And if you hear what he's talking about tokenization across the board. Both of these people used to be huge skeptics about Bitcoin. Now they're both talking about how Bitcoin is probably going to be a safe haven asset for humanity going forward.
It did briefly touch $100,000 in December to retrace. As you said, you are expecting a higher Bitcoin price in the longer term, but there will be volatility. When we last chatted, you put $899,000 potentially on the table. I see there are some forecasters out there who actually see it going way beyond that. Give us a view of how you are putting together that longer term forecast.
Sure. So to be clear, that's quite a conservative forecast, according to many, as you said. There are some people with a base case of about $13 million per Bitcoin and much higher in the future. Obviously, we're not talking about the next few months, right? We're talking about a long-term view about what this asset class could be valued at in the longer term. The way I come to my $899,000, if you look at the market valuation of all gold that exists in the world, that's about $18 trillion. And if you look at the market valuation of Bitcoin, we're just around the $2 trillion mark, much less than the $18 trillion. And if you said that gold needs to get to Bitcoin needs to get to the gold's market valuation, then the Bitcoin supply cannot increase. It's a function of its protocol. The only way for it to get to that valuation is for the price to increase. And the price per Bitcoin would have to be $899,000 to do that. Now, many people believe that Bitcoin is not only a gold 2.0, but it is a gold, is an asset that is like gold that will far surpass the use of gold because of all the negative drawbacks of gold, because it's bulky and it's heavy and it's difficult to divide and it's not divisible and you can't pay for small amounts with, for your day-to-day transactions. So there's a lot of views that, A, there's a technological breakthrough that allows micropayments with Bitcoin in the future, but that it's also just got all the attributes of gold, but as well as the attributes of the digital space that will take it beyond the market valuation of gold.
Let's talk a bit about the safe haven status, which you mentioned a moment ago, particularly in light of the geopolitical environment that we're facing. And we just see the headlines coming through loud and clear. The most recent is Israel has wiped out through airstrikes 80% of Syria's military capacity. There is no shortage of headlines to ignite an asset that has that safe haven status, Fazam.
That's true. And I think, you know, there's a couple of things about safe haven statuses. Number one is, like, what is the mentality of the financial establishment across the world? And where do they think their financial assets are safe? Historically, it's been gold, it's been, you know, treasury bonds and US bonds. The U.S. bond has changed, you know, since 2011, when the U.S. government's credit rating was downgraded from you know, the highest level, one notch down. And there's been a whole spate of discussions about their debt ceiling and you know, real issues around the U.S. financial situation. People have continued to look at gold, but they're also now looking to say, hey, is this financial paradigm changing? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that as a safe haven, we're literally talking about many people, for example, in Ukraine, when there were issues with Russia and Ukraine at the beginning of the war, who there were many stories that came out that thank goodness for crypto because their financial infrastructure around them was crumbling. And the only way in which they were actually be able to safeguard some of their assets, to have a literal safe haven for their assets, was in crypto, because they didn't have to rely on any financial intermediary. And the central bank had some issues. The banks had, if obviously, issues they couldn't open during the beginning of the war. So this safe haven status, I think, will get a lot more meaning to it as we see the state of the world escalate into areas that are quite precarious at the moment.
The next catalyst for the next rally, anything on the horizon other than perhaps when Trump takes office?
You know, I think we're in quite a euphoric state right now in the markets, where people think that the Trump's policies, he's been very pro-crypto, crypto's gone up, the markets have gone up, pro-business, etc. We've just seen the headline numbers in the CPI come up a little bit higher than what they were before at 2.7%. I think if we look forward, fast forward a couple of years, we're going to see that potentially that euphoric feeling about the promise of what the future could be is much less, you know, much less high. Let's put it that way. And I think that we could start to see that there will be disruptions and some lost or unmet expectations of what this promise is. And I think at that time, Bitcoin can do a couple of things and crypto can do a couple of things. Number one, it could start going down if the market goes down. If the market goes down, it could be going up. But I think there's a lot of a narrative, there's a big narrative to say that we're in a very easy financial environment from the central banks around the world, particularly with the Federal Reserve, that we may be seeing just a continual rise of financial asset prices across the board. So there might not be one explicit event, but I do expect financial assets to continue rising in the short to medium term.
As Fazam and I discussed on the geopolitical front, Israel says it has wiped out 70 to 80% of Syria's military capacity through airstrikes. Here's Bloomberg's Sam Dagger with the details.
Let's start talking about what Israel has been doing since the fall of the Assad regime. The IDF, Israeli government, sense an opportunity to sort of continue with this momentum of weakening some of their quote-unquote enemies who sit on the sidelines. So tell us what's going on there.
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite dramatic. I mean, this has not happened since the agreement that was in place in 1974. So you can imagine, I mean, this was the armistice that ended the, you know, 1973 war between Syria and Israel and other Arab powers. And this was an agreement that was negotiated by the Americans. So this is really significant, mm-hmm. the incursion. And it was condemned by several Arab states, yeah. as a violation of international law. But Israel has come out and said, no, we are actually very concerned about what has happened in Syria, the swift toppling of Assad, the takeover of the rebels who are, you know, headed by this Islamist group that used to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. So what they hit, I think, are what they consider the places that hold the weapons that pose the greatest risk to Israel. So, yes, you mentioned the airfields. You've got jets that could, like, fly and attack Israel. And also, I was told that one of the most significant sites hit by Israel is directly north of Damascus in an area called Al-Qalamun, which is adjacent to Lebanon. And then there you have several bases that actually store Scuds. I mean, with warheads. I mean, we don't know what the warheads hold, but Israel destroyed all of that. Yeah. And they also hit the port in Latakia. I'm being told that there were ships there that Iran loaded with weapons that it wanted to take somewhere.
Yeah. What do you think Israel's endgame is here? Because they say that they've destroyed 70 to 80% of Syria's military capabilities. Does it end there, or are we likely to get another ground incursion similar to what happened in Lebanon?
I think at the moment, anything can happen and things can change depending on how the situation evolves on the ground in Syria. I mean, everybody is taking this wait and see attitude. It's not only Israel, the U.S., the Europeans, all the other powers, even the Arabs. I mean, yes, they have embassies there. I mean, a lot of them have reopened to Saudi Arabia. Egypt is there. The UAE is there. Their representatives met with, you know, officials from this transition government that was appointed.
On the energy front, BP and Shell have spent $18 billion over the last 5 years on electricity generation. Current management teams at both companies say they don't think they have the strength of balance sheet to meet their needs for their renewable energy hopes. We caught up with the FT's Sonia Hudson, who speaks to the FT energy expert Malcolm Moore.
BP and Shell are scaling back their ambitions to become big players in electricity. Both oil majors invested billions of dollars over the past few years into renewables, but they haven't seen a lot of results. And that's put BP and Shell in a tough spot between pro-fossil fuel and pro-climate investors. Here to explain is the FT's Malcolm Moore. Hey, Malcolm.
Hi there.
What exactly were BP and Shell's ambitions in this space? What sort of plans did they have?
Okay, so we have to go back to, I guess, in Shell's case, we have to go back to 2016, and in BP's case, slightly after that. And both of these companies really sort of laid out a vision of what their future business was going to be when people stopped buying oil. And their long-term vision was, well, look, we're going to keep on producing oil and gas in the short term, but we're going to start getting into electricity because electricity is the kind of energy of the future, right? So they invested in, you know, offshore wind, solar, electric vehicle charging, and of course, they built up power trading units.
And obviously, like I mentioned, that has not worked out like they hoped it would, and they're now scaling back. Can you give me a few details about what that pullback is looking like?
Well, so the thing about renewables is that the cost of building all the wind farms, installing all the solar panels, that stuff is difficult to do, and it really stretched their balance sheet. And so essentially now they're saying, well, look, instead of spending billions and billions on building wind farms and so on, we're not going to really look for any more of those projects. That's what Shell has said. BP, meanwhile, has put all of its offshore wind business into a joint venture with a Japanese company called JERA, and that basically moves it off its balance sheet in the future. And what they're saying is not so much that the business is doing terribly, but we may not have a competitive advantage in this area. Which is the case, right? There are lots of renewable companies out there that really are very good at this process. The oil majors are just saying, well, we may not have a competitive advantage in this area.
What's been the response to this push into electricity from pro-fossil fuel investors and also from pro-climate investors?
Yeah, so this is the real difficult dilemma that these companies face. And it was sketched out to me by the chief exec of another energy company. He basically said, look, if you're a publicly listed oil and gas company, your shareholders have bought you because they like the returns of oil and gas. How do you totally transform that shareholder base into a shareholder base that likes green energy? Because those are two different sets of people, basically. And the problem that you have is that your fossil fuel shareholders are going to sell out as you start building these green businesses and their returns go down. But your green investors are not going to buy until you hit a certain level of greenness. And so there's a kind of a valley of death that you have to cross, because you may not get to that greenness before all of your shareholders have sold out.
So on the path to trying to get those new investors in, you're in a spot where your share price tanks because no one's interested in you on either side.
Yeah, so that's what we've seen. Like this year, BP's share price is down more than 16%. We've seen this huge valuation gap between the share prices of US oil and gas companies like Exxon and Chevron, who haven't really got into any of this electricity business, and the European oil majors, all of whom have been dabbling but are now kind of pulling back.
All right, so how are BP and Shell trying to claw their way out of this so-called valley of death that they're in?
So they're taking different approaches. For Shell, I think, you know, they've got a really sizable gas business. And so they're saying, look, we think that gas is going to be the fuel of the transition. It's slightly lower carbon than oil. And so we're going to focus on gas. And then we're going to focus on the other things that we know how to do. So, you know, biofuels. And BP is kind of also saying the same. They're saying, look, maybe less electricity. We're exploring in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we're going to try and find more oil and gas.
Malcolm Moore is the FT's energy editor. Thanks, Malcolm.
Thank you.
Staying with energy, but back in South Africa, the National Energy Regulator of South Africa's public hearings into the proposed increase, 66% increase in electricity prices over the next 3 years. Those hearings came to an end today. BizNews' Chris Steyn spoke to Prisma's Paul Null, who presented at the hearings and who is proposing that bankrupt municipalities in South Africa be liquidated and that money be used to pay back Eskom.
And the Municipal Finance Management Act is very clear in terms I think it is sections 153 and 155, but I must make sure that a municipality that is dysfunctional over a period, and of course we can easily confirm that with analyzing these financial statements and see what the services are and are they measuring against the treasury norms and standards. By the way, that must be enforced in terms of the constitution, section 216. And you know, the MFMA provide that solution, and that is to liquidate these municipalities after all the intervention processes of provincial and national treasury were not successful, which would be very easy to confirm within the financial statements. And, you know, to liquidate the municipalities, it's more business rescue. It's not the same as what we understand under liquidation with the private sector or any other business or private person, where all the assets is sold, not with a municipality. It is only the non-essential assets that must be sold, and the full amount of that should be provided for full settlement for all its obligations, which is basically Eskom and the water boards. And perhaps I should just add here, these 90 billion rand, or it's perhaps much more now, that is owed to Eskom, and there's also many billions owed to Rand Water. This money has been impaired in terms of financial statement standards. So we have already paid for this losses on this impaired money. But the situation cannot go forward like this. So what the act is stating is that you not only pay all the obligations, you get also a court order in terms of the MFMA to get rid of the whole council, as well as of all officials that are not adding value to the municipality. And of course, this would be a new process to get new officials. But you know, new councillors. But the big advantage of such a drastic step is that you will have a metro or municipality with a clean sheet, with no obligations.
Trump has already reverted to running the U.S. economy via his X platform. In his latest tweet, he promises to fast-track permits for big investors into the U.S. The Bloomberg team has more.
We saw the post on Truth. He says, get ready to rock, with 3 exclamation points. What does that mean?
It's all up to us to determine, I think, at this point. I mean, look, this is a social media post. Uh-huh. It is not a detailed policy plan. And yet we know from Trump's history a little bit about what he's going for here. He's clearly indicated a preference for expediting big projects, particularly mm-hmm. energy projects. That was a feature of his campaigning for the presidency. But it's also something he tried in his first term, and he's not alone. President Biden has also tried to expedite permitting. Former President Obama also tried to expedite permitting. It's just very difficult for presidents to do this in a meaningful, long-lasting way unilaterally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in part, I would imagine that's because it needs congressional action, and therein lies a hiccup oftentimes. But to what extent could you get around this by just appointing regulators, like, say, Lee Zeldin at the EPA, who just don't enforce the existing regulations? If you're not suing anyone, you just kind of let things go. Do the regulations really exist at all?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think we're talking about two things here. One, sure. You can do some stuff administratively. You can put a shot clock on agencies trying to get them to move faster. You can identify high priority projects and say these are going to move through the system a little bit faster, get to approvals. That's what all 3 presidents have tried to do to some degree. What you're talking about is another feature of this, which is where the regulatory agencies can, in fact, expedite things. They can do quicker reviews. They can maybe say some regulations don't apply. I mean, we are expecting, of course, many of the regulations that apply to the kinds of projects that Trump is saying he wants to prioritize to be eased, just as they were during Trump's first term. There was an effort during Trump's first term to limit how much states could block projects that had a water pollution risk. That was effective for a few years. It was rolled back under Biden. But that's the kind of thing we could see again, done again by these agencies.
You just brushed up against something important, and that's energy. That's what we're talking about here, basically, is we're talking climate regulations, likely in energy applications. That's where we're going here.
I mean, I think we're talking about environmental reviews broadly, whether it's climate or conventional impacts. I mean, the U.S., essentially, if you're a big project developer, and Trump knows this well as a real estate developer,
absolutely.
You've got to get so many permits, you've got to clear so many reviews, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are tied to a 1970 environmental law that says any federal nexus, any project that has a federal nexus, it's an airport, it's mm-hmm. a solar array, an oil well on federal land, that those have to go through this level of scrutiny. And so really, that's right now, there's a big emphasis on getting the energy that we need. That's Trump's priority here.
Let's have a look at the markets on the local front. The market relatively subdued as we move deeper and deeper into the silly season. We had resources relatively flat. Industrials, the only positive sign on the local market today, up 0.25%. And financials, the biggest losers, down almost 0.75%. Looking at currencies, Bitcoin a short while ago was at $99,496. We've got the dollar rand at 17.75 and the pound rand at 22.65. On the local front, Barlow World was the big mover up today, more than 15.5% to the positive. That on news that Saudi company Zahid has offered 22.8 billion rand for the company. That is a 30% premium to Tuesday's closing price for Barlow World. world, and the company is also set to delist from the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Elfman with a strong showing today, and Sibanye adding 2.33%. On the downside, we had Pick n Pay falling more than 7%, Nedbank giving up 5%, and Sasol losing 4.5%. So that brings us to the end of today's BizNews briefing. Those numbers that you're seeing right now are from yesterday's market briefing. But Alec Hogg will be back in the hot seat with your BizNews briefing, 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. From myself, Bronwyn Nielsen, have a good night.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.